Hey everyone, this is John.
And this is Ryan.
And this is the Nickel Film Podcast, episode 47, the movie podcast of Gamers Unanimous. If this is your first time listening, thanks for joining us. You can download previous episodes on iTunes, just do a search for Gamers Unanimous. There you'll also find our other podcasts, the John and Carlos Show and the Nintendo Show. And you can also listen to all of our previous episodes on our website, GamersUnanimous.com. On today's show, we're going to review the new movie, The Secret World of Arrietty, and have our Netflix Pick of the Week discussion and list our top five animated films. But first up, Ryan, what have you been watching?
I had two movies to talk about. The first of which, this is one that I'm revisiting, and it's a great movie called Birth. Are you familiar with this, by any chance?
Oh, sure. Nicole Kidman?
Uh-huh. Have you seen this?
No, but I think we've talked about this a little bit before. Is it on Netflix yet?
I don't believe so. I watched it on a DVD. Like, I got this, I do the movie night, and this is one that I nominated, and it got picked. So
nice.
It's really fresh in my mind. I just watched it yesterday. And, you know, I really do love this movie. I think it is a misunderstood and underappreciated gem of a film. It's got a 40% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Huh.
It is not a very well-liked movie. And it's kind of because it's got a... Are you familiar with the premise of the
yes.
movie?
Yes.
Yes, it's,
Nicole Kidman, her husband dies, and then years later there's this child who claims to be the reincarnation of her husband.
Mm-hmm. And he kind of shows up and seems to have... really does seem to be the embodiment of him. He knows all of this information about him. Claims it's sort of like he experiences all of this as deja vu, even though he's just a child. Like, mm-hmm. He doesn't understand how... Like, her dead husband was, like, a professor who gave lectures on, splitting the atom, they say. And, like, he doesn't understand it, but he has this vague idea of what it's supposed to be, or at least he claims to. And, I really love this movie. It's so dark and dreary, but it's also set in, like, this upper crust New York location. It's kind of like, it feels like it's heavily inspired by, or it really wants to be, like, a Kubrick or, like, Roman Polanski film. It's just so beautifully shot. The soundtrack to it is amazing. And it's just one of these, really just a dark psychological drama. And you really don't really know where the story is going to go, and it has just this really brutal climax at the end of the movie that really it haunts. Like, this is the kind of movie that will stick with me after seeing it.
You know, when you mentioned Kubrick and Polanski, I wanted to look it up and see who did direct this one.
Oh, Jonathan Glazer, yeah. He's the guy that, this is, I think, is only his second movie he ever did. He also did Sexy Beast, which is another fantastic film. He directs music videos sometimes, but...
He doesn't really make features too often. He's got something called Under the Skin that's in post-production now, but that'll be his third full-length feature.
Oh, very good.
Anyway. Oh, and it's got Scarlett Johansson.
This is the one where she's like an alien or something, and she's interacting with all these different people. Like, I've read a little bit about this movie. I'm not really sure what to expect from it, but this guy's an amazing director. So his third movie in 10 years, I guess this will be,
yeah.
or 12 years. So I'm really excited to see what comes of this. Really a fantastic director.
Very cool. I got three movies I want to talk about. I'm just going to do them in rapid fire here because I don't really have too much to say about them. I saw What's Your Number, which is that new one with Anna Faris, came out this past summer, this past fall. And it's a really formulaic rom-com that's supposed to have this raunchy edge, but the edge is real dull. Like, there's mm-hmm. nothing... I mean, it's not even as edgy as like some newer Apatow productions. It seems like it's trying to follow in that kind of vein where it has this raunchiness but a good heart to it, but the humor just is pretty clean compared to some other contemporary comedy movies, and none of the jokes really land too well. It's a pretty lackluster movie. I also saw Sanctum, which I believe came out about a year ago, because it got released in the dead of winter last year, mm-hmm. and it is just a mess of a cave and adventure film.
Yeah.
There's nothing really good to say about Sanctum. I remember when the previews were first released for this one, James Cameron had his name on it, and then quickly took it off, because I think he realized what direction this movie was going in, in the previews anyway. And you can still find his name buried under a bunch of other producers in the credits if you make it all the way to the end of this movie, but it hits all these really cliche, like, father-son coming of age and coming to understand each other beats, and the adventure scenes in it with, you know, caves swimming with water aren't anything new or anything really exciting either. Okay. And I also saw the remake of Straw Dogs, which is an acceptable substitute for the original, because there was a time where the original was actually hard to get to. You couldn't find it at any video rental stores. You couldn't get it on Netflix. But the original is now finally available to rent on Netflix through their disc service. So I don't think there's any reason to see the new one instead of the original.
Well, I don't know why they remade it. If the first one was already banned in the first place, why not just have a re-release of the movie? Like,
right.
This movie is now finally acceptable. You know, let's put this back. Because it's a fantastic film.
Yeah. And I actually have the original in my queue now. There's still a real long wait for it. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, if...
I mean, I got it on DVD if you want to borrow it.
Yeah, very cool.
It's a great movie.
Because, but yeah, the from what I understand, this new one is a pretty straight remake. Doesn't really bring anything new to the table. But, you know, maybe upon seeing the old one again, because it's been years and years since I've seen it, I'll be able to discover why a remake was merited. But, you know, it's fine, but yeah, no real reason to rush out and see it or see this one over the original if you have a choice between the two. But that's all I got. What else you got on tap?
Yeah. I got one more movie and a quick series I wanted to talk about, too, as well.
Very good.
To get rid of the movie first, I got around to seeing The Woman in Black. Are you familiar with this one?
Yeah, the Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah, just came out, like, earlier this month.
Mm-hmm.
So I finally got around to seeing it, and I got to say, I was really impressed by this movie.
Really?
I didn't know what it was.
Very good.
What I was expecting. The moment that I saw the production company, and this is great, it's made by Hammer. Who has made so many schlocky B-horror movies dating back into the 50s and 60s. Like, they've just been around forever, and they've, you know, produced so many movies. And it makes me think of, like, did you remember when we saw I Saw the Devil? Did you see that one?
I didn't see it. I remember you talking about that one, though.
Well, like, that movie is it's definitely an homage. It's like a throwback to 80s slasher movies, and that's precisely what this movie is trying to be. It's using the same kind of framework and storytelling that you get from, like, you know, Roger Corman movies or Hammer productions, but it actually doesn't have, like, the B-movie cheapness to it. It's actually got a pretty good budget, and it looks pretty good. I mean, the story itself is based off of, apparently it's based off of a classic British horror story of a guy who is like, in Victorian era, he's like a solicitor. Which means that he handles litigious stuff for common people. So he travels to this town.
Like an ambulance chaser or something?
Well, I mean, like, if they were selling their house.
Oh, okay.
And they owned property but didn't have the background to, you know, transfer it mm-hmm. properly, like, to get the paperwork done, they would hire this guy to show up and make sure that nothing shady was going on.
Right.
He's just sort of an intermediary for the courts. And he also, and I guess fitting with birth, he's also a widower. He lost his wife when she was giving birth to his kid. So he shows up to this town, and inexplicably, all of these children just start committing suicide in very horrific fashions. And the town people kind of start blaming him for it. And as he, because he sort of, like, shows up at the worst possible time for a lot of this stuff. It sort of paints him like he could either be involved, or it's just like he might just be a harbinger of doom. But what it really is the entire time he sees this, as the title is called, The Woman in Black, who is just like this appalled woman who you really don't ever see her face, but it's a lot of like really gratuitous jump scares and lots of, you know, you see the figure behind him when he's just examining something in a room, and then the camera pans back and it's gone. I gotta say, like, it's a really competently made movie. I don't say it was a really well made movie. It's a competently made movie. The scares are great. Like, they're just so over the top. You really got to appreciate them just for the balls of them willing to just outright just jump scare you for no reason ever. And the woman herself is actually really fucking scary. Like, they did a great job of making her be, like, you know, in Insidious, at the end of Insidious, how it just totally falls apart because they're not believable.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Imagine if they were actually kind of believable. Imagine if you had some genuine fear of those ghosts. It's kind of like that.
Oh. Like all those, like, the frozen people in, are you talking about?
Yeah. When they're in, like, that weird limbo state.
Or whatever. Yeah.
I thought it was great. And, you know, Daniel Radcliffe, I don't know if this is his first movie, but it's one of his first movies post-Harry Potter. And he's not a distraction at all. I don't look at him and see Harry Potter anymore. He's just does a great job of being like this sympathetic father.
When he's running from ghosts, you're not like Expecto Patronum.
No, when he's not even really running that much, he's just sort of he's trying to help. You know, he really wants to help, but he's just kind of always getting screwed over in the end, it seems. But yeah, like, I really did like this movie. I think it's really good, and it's probably still going to be in theaters maybe for another week or two. So
yeah,
scope it out if you can.
So you had an anime series you want to talk about too, right?
Oh yeah, Dance of the Vampire Bund. And this is kind of a really bizarre series. It's only 12 episodes, and it is available right now on Netflix. But, you know, this will be sort of a cautionary review of it because this is some really bizarre stuff. You know how, like, the whole vampire werewolf like love triangle genre has emerged, and it's really big and they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And they're usually like these sort of like romantic stories of these different guys fighting over women. Like, imagine if instead of it being about romance and true love, it's from the male's perspective and it's all about like just straight up sex and violence.
Very good.
And that's kind of what this is about. To preface it, there is a lot, and they get away with it because I guess it's animated, but there is a lot of like prepubescent sex.
Oh.
So that is ripe with this. It's very bizarre. But it centers around, it's like supposed to be set in modern times, and like there's this vampire princess who decides to out vampires to the world. And as a show of good faith, decides to pay off all of Japan's national debt because they have a shit ton of money. And she has this bodyguard werewolf kid named Akira that's there to protect her, but is also at the same time her love interest. And people, like the humans, aren't that pleased with this event, and neither are the vampires. So everyone's trying to kill her, and it's his job to protect her. But at the same time, because this is also, you know, anime series, she enrolls at the high school he's at, and like all of this just shit ensues. It is really graphically violent. There's the occasional rape, there's a little bit of rape in this one.
Just the appropriate amount of rape.
A pinch of rape. Yeah, I mean, you have underage sex with children, boys and girls. So it's you know, it's fair play for everybody involved. I think they get away with it.
Everyone's anus is open for business.
Well, I think they get away with it with the women or with the girl because she's supposed to be like this 5,000-year-old vampire or something. Not 5,000, 500-year-old vampire. And she's supposed to have, I guess, the mentality of an adult. The young boy, however, is still a young boy. And he's totally having sex with, like, adult women, which is bizarre. But the thing that's as bizarre as this show is, it is like this total wish fulfillment in like the most sadistic manner you can imagine. It's and like this kid Akira, who's like supposed to be the main guy that the, you know, your audience is projecting themselves into. It's not even like he has these options. Like, he has her. He's got like this vampire princess girl. He's got the popular girl at the high school he's attending that he's also dating. And then on the side, he also has a third relationship with another werewolf hot woman bodyguard. So it's like he's not running out of women to get with in this show. There's really no flaw to him at all, ever, under any circumstance. And it's, God, this is such a weird show. The funny thing is, though, it's actually got a sense of humor about it and a bizarre kind of twisted sort of way. It makes fun of itself a lot, and it makes fun of a lot of the cutesy stuff associated with anime the whole time. Like, she's got like the main vampire woman's got these three maids that are always there, and they're always there to like crack a joke or to be funny, but they're also kind of like bodyguards in their own way. It is again, like I said, very sadistic. Good news, it's only 12 episodes, so it is a quick watch if you want to get through this thing. There have even been like fights with the censors over whether or not they can actually show this series, but somehow Netflix has it. So, if you want to see the the worst and maybe the best of sadism that Netflix has to offer. This is it.
All right, very good. So let's go ahead, let's stay on the animation road and talk about Fire and Ice, which is our Netflix Watch Instant Pick of the Week. So our Netflix Pick of the Week this week is Fire and Ice. So go ahead and break it down for us. Give us a plot synopsis here, Ryan.
Well, Fire and Ice, it came out in 1983, and it's by Ralph Boschke, who is known for, known for animation, and he's known for rotoscoping. He's made a lot of really interesting stuff, a lot of psychedelic things. He did, Fritz the Cat. He did the animated Lord of the Rings, which is basically the first book and then half of the second, and it kind of is condensed. It doesn't really tell you the whole story.
Yeah, back in 78, I remember watching this one as a kid, and the art style, I didn't realize what rotoscoping was, back then. But the art style in that one was actually a little bit frightening as a kid, how smooth the animations were and how realistic some of the things looked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's interesting to watch Fire and Ice is that this is after he's sort of perfected what he's been doing with it, or at least getting it to a much more evolved state. I think it's a lot more fluid when you watch Fire and Ice. And the story of it is, basically a battle of good and evil, like typical Sword and Shield fantasy stuff. And, there's the evil ice monster people, and then there's the good... What would you say, they're Nordic warriors, basically.
That live in a volcano.
Yeah. And it's just sort of watching the main hero try to rescue the woman. It's, very straightforward, fantasy that you could expect. And I think, I don't want to jump into my review of it. I kind of want to get your take. But I think that this is definitely the most progressed his style is. And it's the most clean looking and well animated.
Yeah, and you definitely get a lot of the real smooth character movements. Something about the way their mouths are moving in dialogue, I don't think translated 100% correctly.
Yeah.
But
it's almost like they're skipping moments, but then moving fluidly anyways. It just hits these kind of bizarre points at which you think their faces would be at the time, but doesn't capture really their emotiveness.
Yeah, and it is very purely steeped in that fantasy aesthetic, with people wearing hardly any clothing, even less than people would wear in 300.
Oh, yeah.
And swords and flying on pterodactyls and all kinds of magic. Where
like her micro bikini.
Exactly.
Designed for optimum war.
So the story is just your basic hero's journey or damsel in distress kind of story. Mm-hmm. There's not a whole lot of depth to these characters. You have your character of Larn, who is this guy whose village has been destroyed by the evil sorcerer and his mom, who are basically moving glaciers in order to expand their territory. Mm-hmm. And they command these pack of wild people who live in the ice. And
your typical trolls or orcs,
right? Exactly. Yeah. And for the first maybe 20 minutes of the movie, I thought it was maybe a little bit racist because all the good people were white and all the bad people had dark skin. Mm-hmm. And then, eventually you meet some other characters along the way who are darker skinned. But none of the characters really have much more depth to them than you see at the surface, where you have the guy whose village has been destroyed and now he's your hero and he's out to rescue the girl. And the girl is very much a damsel in distress who has moments of usefulness but is mostly just there to be kidnapped.
Yeah.
And then there's the one guy.
Well, and for the sake of eye candy, we can't overlook that.
Well, sure, yeah.
I mean, isn't it great that this, I would have loved to have just seen this woman in real life. Good Lord, she is just stacked.
And there's the one guy who wears the wolf helmet, and you can just see his green eyes, and he's just there to kick some ass from time to time and bail them out whenever they're in a situation.
Oh yeah, he just kind of shows up out of nowhere just to kick some ass every once in a while. He's pretty cool.
Yeah, and there's really no explanation for why he is in on this adventure. He's, I guess, maybe revenge. He's just out for revenge, and for some reason he sees these two characters as his vehicle for getting his revenge. Anyway,
It is definitely a threadbare story.
Yeah, and the it's really all about the art, I think. And yeah, it's a really interesting exercise in that rotoscope technology and an animation. And, you know, it's aged because, you know, this was, what, 25 years ago?
Yeah, 28 years ago.
Yeah, a long time back. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so, but I don't think there's, like, anything... There's no reason to depreciate it because of that. You know, it's a movie of its time.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that there's a psychedelic nature to it that can be enjoyed as well. I think it's an enjoyable film. I really did like this a lot. I don't know. I think that you really have to understand the limitations of the storytelling to just roll with it and just accept that it's going to be this bare bones.
You can accept it as like a solid genre exercise. Mm-hmm. You know, it's 81 minutes long, so
that's true.
It's not like you're
not committing that much time to it.
Yeah, it's this is not Lord of the Rings where you're going to be sitting down for 3 hours and trudging through.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you have anything else you want to say about Fire and Ice?
Not really. I think it's great. And it is available on Netflix, right?
Yep.
Very good.
So let's take a quick break and move into a review of The Secret World of Arrietty. The Secret World of Arrietty is about the Clock family, who are 4-inch-tall people who live anonymously in another family's residence, borrowing simple items like sugar or tissues to make their home. Life changes for the Clocks when their daughter Arrietty, is discovered by Sean, a boy who moves into the house because of some health problems. Now, this movie is directed by, and I'm going to butcher this name horribly, Hiromasa
Yonabayashi?
That was good.
Oh,
I'm going to have you read those names from now on. It's his first directorial title, as I'm looking him up on IMDb here. But he was an animator on a lot of recognizable anime movies like Princess Mononoke, Spirited Away.
With Studio Ghibli, it seems.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Howl's Moving Castle, Ponyo. Yeah, so he's pretty steeped in animation. And how do you think this movie stands up to a lot of those more recognizable, more popular animation movies?
Oh, I think it fits in quite well with what they've put out over the years. And I think that this is, in a lot of ways, I know you haven't seen it yet, but I feel like this is, in a lot of ways, a spiritual sequel to Ponyo.
Yeah, that was one that I wanted to talk about, but I haven't seen it yet. It was available on Netflix Watch instantly,
mm-hmm.
and then I don't know how long ago it got removed, but it's not there anymore.
Yeah, well, and Ponyo is like, for starters, Ponyo is really very much an aquatic story. It's so much about water, and it's about family, and in the same way, so is Arrietty, and it's about her family, and it's also seemingly more geared around plant life. I don't think there's a single shot in the whole movie where you're not being confronted by plant life of some nature.
Yeah, everything was very organic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a testament to their ability to have these, it's like grounded fantasy, like child fantasy, but it's not like over the top.
Yeah, and when you compare this one to some of the other movies we listed off before, like Spirited Away, things like that, it's very grounded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love this movie. I think that Because you know, you're watching these this little family that lives inside of the, you know, inside of the floorboards of the house that are slowly being discovered by this one little kid who is sort of caught on to the fact that they and then, like they say, they're borrowers, not like thieves, they're not stealing a whole bunch, but they'll just they'll take small little things, just the just enough to support their existence.
Yeah, a cube of sugar, mm-hmm. or yeah. something like that. So and. What I really like about this movie is the attention to detail, especially since they're little people, and you get this the sense of how massive the world would see to them. Like, you get, like, the green...
Oh, there's a vastness of space that is... Like, in the opening sequence, when they show them exploring the kitchen.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, like, this huge open cavern, and then you see it from their perspective, and you understand just how massive everything around them is.
And also, like, I like seeing the little touches of... Like the grain in the wood that you get a lot more detail in when you're seeing it from that close up.
Yeah.
And especially in their home, like all like the little props that they use, like there's pictures on their wall and the pictures are stamps.
Yeah.
And it's those little touches that really bring this movie to life.
Oh, it's like they found ways to repurpose all of these little items and conform them to what it must be like to be 4 inches tall. And like have all of these little items make sense in their world and how they're able to recreate everything they would need from watching these other people live.
Yeah. And you know, I want to take a brief look at the cast here. I think the only two people that I recognize as being in other stuff before, you get, the Carol Burnett is the voice of Hara, who kind of takes the role of the antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
She's the housekeeper who... also seems to catch on, like, as the boy starts to catch on more and, like, starts to interact more with the main character, Arietti. She's the housekeeper who starts to suspect something's up and takes the role of the more malicious figure who's trying to uncover their existence and then prove to the world that they exist.
And it's weird how villainous she becomes in it, too.
Yeah.
Like, how you kind of really grow to just hate her. And, like, it's not even... she's obsessed with, I guess, being proven right, which doesn't really mean all that much. When you think about how great this discovery would be, it's not, you know, the matter that she was right all along. It's like, who's going to care about that? And she's obsessed with capturing them and containing them and controlling them. It's not like she's has these benevolent intentions with these people.
And they do an okay job sort of building her frustration. You know, the more she kind of discovers things out of place and weird things going on, she tries to prove their existence. I don't know if it was ever her frustration built to the point where I was really 100% on board with how malicious she became. But again, if they were more focused on that character, it would detract from everyone else. So I think they reached a suitable balance for making her the antagonist without taking away from the really whimsical nature of the rest of the movie.
Yeah, it is ultimately a kid's movie. They don't want her to be too evil.
Yeah, it's a kid's movie, and it's not condescending at all.
Yeah.
It expects you to take, and expects the audience to take, the initiative and figure things out and realize what's going on without getting too expository at any point, except for the one scene, which I don't want to give too much away from it, but there's a scene where... the boy explains quite a bit about this health condition he has and how it sort of changed his perspective on life.
Yeah.
And that was the only real scene where...
It was a very weighty topic in the middle of the movie for a kid's film. One where they hadn't really approached... There hadn't really even been all that much meaningful dialogue, even. I mean, there's, you know, there's a lot of discussion and a lot of things involving family, but that gets into this really existential breakdown of what death may mean.
Yeah, and mortality, it's something that they had touched on a little bit with the mother character early on about, you know, how their family being safe,
mm-hmm.
and if they're in any sort of danger. And this mother character was really panicky, and she's voiced by Amy Poehler in the US version.
Yeah.
And... yeah, but then they just come out and just say it all. So instead of, like, there being really subtle undertones, it got really heavy in there. And, yeah, that was the only part in the movie where I felt myself taken out of this world that they had built. But otherwise, yeah, it's a very, very limited dialogue, and they don't really spell too much out. And a lot of, like, process shots of climbing and, like, all the things they have to do to move around.
Yeah.
And I really liked those shots, you know, especially, again, in the kitchen or a part where she's climbing up to the roof.
Well, there's great attention paid to the logistics of living the lives that they do.
Yeah.
They clearly show you, you know, all of these well, you know, traveled paths that they take throughout the arteries of the house. You really get a good sense of the mechanics of the world they live in.
Yeah, and they feel very lived in to this location, this movie. They're as much residents of this house as the people who hold the title deed.
Yeah.
What else did you want to talk about with Ari? Anything else coming to mind?
Well, one thing that we haven't talked about yet, and I thought it was especially noticeable because we had the great speakers around us, but fantastic sound.
Oh, yeah. Almost, I noticed. Yeah.
Like every single action in the movie seemed to have a corresponding sound, whether it was the most subtle use. I mean, it seems like such great attention to detail throughout the entire movie, not just visually, but also just with the audio.
Yeah, fantastic sound editing and sound mixing. Not just like with their footsteps, but I'm trying to remember what the sound effect they used, but there was a sound in the kitchen, and I remember it's like a point of view shot, and she's looking around, and as she's looking around, you can hear the sound fading in and out between the speakers. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something that you notice more in a movie theater or if you have a nice speaker system set up at home.
Yeah.
But there's a ton of details like that they pay to the sound.
Oh, and like a great shot early on in the movie when they're trying to pull the tissue out.
Yeah.
And you because of the oppressive nature of the clock ticking, you're focusing so
yes.
much on that sound and not at all about what's going on in front of her, so that when they drop the curtain, like when the curtain itself, you know, the tissue, and you see that the boy is just sitting there staring at them. You know, it's actually, it really caught me off guard. I like that. It was a great little touch there.
And the sound of the clock reminds me of something else I wanted to talk about with the sound. The sound is sort of distorted to where it sounds more massive than it is, but it's always really recognizable mm-hmm. what things are. And I think it's a really fantastic job of sound design there to have these things that, you know, this is how it would probably sound if you were 4 inches tall.
Well, the only time they really don't do that, which is interesting, is when they're actually communicating with each other.
Yeah.
When you notice yeah. that you don't hear like a little squeaky voice coming out of her when she's talking to him, you just hear her.
Yeah,
you know, as you would normally would, and then and maybe it's because they're cutting back and forth from each's perspective of what their own voice sounds like, but you never really get that sense of it.
Yeah, which I don't know. I think that might be distracting if you like had to hold her up to her.
Oh every yeah, time like I'm not saying that. I want that. It's just
yeah, a little bit of a leap in logic there, but
yeah,
an acceptable one.
It's forgivable.
And there was one more thing about sound I wanted to mention, and oh, I remember what it was. It was again in the kitchen scene where he uses tape as like sort of suction cups
in a regular
action movie. Yeah, and I thought that was a really clever use of everyday objects, which there's a lot of this in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And how they like retool things to be something else. And also a really good use of sound is you're hearing the tape rip as mm-hmm. he's climbing up a cabinet using these things.
One thing that I thought was really cool. Did you have anything else you wanted to say about sound?
No, go ahead.
Well, one of the things that I thought was neat, and another kind of comparison you can make with this to Ponyo is in Ponyo, again, it's also aquatic, but the water itself is almost bubbly. It's almost like it's got this viscous quality to it.
Yeah.
And when you see the world that they deal with on such a small level, like a drop, water isn't like liquid like it would pour through your hands for them. They're so small that a drop of water would seemingly take some form and some shape.
Yes.
And it's such a great little touch, and it creates kind of a rounded nature to the world.
Yeah, everything just fits together so well
mm-hmm.
that you get drawn in to this world. And even though the plot isn't really rich and full of depth, the world is so rich and full of depth that you can overlook some strange character actions.
Yeah, well, and you know,
mostly
well,
from the housekeeper,
well, and also like Ghibli. You know, they design all sorts of fantasy characters and all sorts of things, and it's really cool how they show you grasshoppers and they show you rats and crows, and all of which take an almost, they're real animals, and yet they're almost animated in this sort of fantasy aesthetic that I think works so well in this movie.
Yeah, and you get a different perspective on all these animals because you're seeing them through the eyes of a 4-inch tall person. You know, the way she interacts with bugs, and the scene with the crow, which I think was a really yes. fantastic scene. And it's so full of humor as well. Not really
yeah.
a lot of humor where you laugh out loud throughout the whole movie, but these little touches where you get things from a different perspective and see things in a different way. And it all makes sense, but you didn't really realize it would be that way before.
Yeah.
So we've been gushing for a while there. Do you have any complaints you want to levy against?
Not really. I mean, I think that this is the sort of film that's easy to fall in love with. Just go in and enjoy it and appreciate the beautiful animation and fantastic storytelling. I really did like this movie a lot.
I really liked it a lot, too. I think it's my favorite movie we've seen so far this year, which, you know, is a little bit of a cheat since I don't think we have seen any movies that were released in 2012 this year. But on another technicality, this movie actually came out in 2010, I believe in Japan. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's...
It took a while to get over here.
Yeah, it did. But it is now playing, and it's in wide release in the U.S., so definitely go check this one out. I was looking at some IMDb charts, and, you know, it's made $14 million, which I couldn't quite tell what the budget was.
We're probably also not the biggest draw for a movie like this. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that this is a much bigger international film than it is here.
Yeah, and I think it's respectable, and I think people are going to see it. It's still in the top 10 after second week of release, which I think is pretty cool. So definitely check this movie out while it's still playing. And if you can catch it on a big screen, that would be phenomenal, because it's a really gorgeous looking movie as well. Mm-hmm. Although the hand drawn art and stuff. And there was one other thing I wanted to mention, but now I can't remember what it was. So let's go ahead and move on.
Well, one last thing that I think would be really, if this is, I mean, maybe I am reading a little too much into it, but maybe if this is like sort of a spiritual sequel, derived from the core elements of what Ponyo is meaning to water and this meaning to plant, I would love to see them tackle another sort of inventive, real life grounded fantasy.
Yeah.
But you know, use some other elements or some other way of working this in, because these are really fascinating kids films that they're making.
Yep, definitely agree. So definitely see Secret World of Arrietty. It's a really good movie. It's a good one to take the kids to. Take them to see this rather than the 3D re-release of Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
It's a much better movie. I think this one will actually pique their curiosity and intrigue them a little bit more than Star Wars would, and seeing people waver on lasers. So let's take a quick break and come back with our top five for the week.
All right.
Our top five for this week is top five animated features. Ryan, did you have any stipulations when you're compiling your list?
I mean, just that, like, this is like an impossible list to compile. It really is, to narrow down five animated movies within the entire scope of animated film.
We had to be broad because we actually just saw the movie when it started 3 hours ago. Yeah. So we're going into this review cold, and we had to pick our top five before we actually saw the movie. So yeah, I decided to stick with children's movies since I knew this movie was rated G and I knew it would be a children's movie. So that's the direction I went with it.
I just tried to create as diverse mix I could by medium and by chronology.
All right, very cool. So what's your number five?
My number five, this is actually a pretty recent one. It came out in 2001, Waking Life by Richard Linklater.
Oh, yeah, I know that one.
And I wanted to mention it specifically for the fact that it's rotoscoped, and we just, you know, did a little mini review of Fire and Ice. But it's not even really, not much of it. It's kind of anti-narrative, I guess you could say. It's just a sort of philosophical, existential think piece where you have all of these different characters that are, as the title of the movie is all about, drifting in and out of this dream state. just, you know, thinking and speculating on existence.
Very good. My number five is pretty standard pick, Toy Story. And I think it's my favorite one in the trilogy, even though I don't think there's a bad one in the bunch of the Toy Story movies. And yeah, it's you know, the toys are coming to life. Everyone's seen Toy Story. They know what this movie's about. But I think that the movie is just filled with a lot of humor. And again, it's a movie that gives you a different perspective on everyday things and finds a lot of the humor and the details of those everyday things, all like Arrietty.
Yeah, that's actually a very apt comparison for the two.
Yeah.
All right, well, on to my number four then. It's Rene Leleux's Fantastic Planet. Came out in 1973. Are you familiar with this?
No, I've never seen that one.
It's a surreal film, and it's got this sort of dystopian sci-fi vibe to it. It's not really for kids. I know this was one that was always on, like, TV late at night when I was growing up. It's got a very distinct art style to it. And it's about these alien looking creatures that keep very tiny human. It's actually kind of, I mean, now that I think about it, it's kind of a lot like Arrietty. Imagine if an entire planet run by aliens that were like the evil old hag woman that wants to kind of control them and have them be their little playthings. It aims to have a deep political meaning behind it of, you know, what enslavement and control means. But it's incredibly trippy. I love the animation style on it. It's really, it's a cool movie. You should definitely check it out.
Yeah, I'm wondering if I'm going to look that one up on Netflix later on. So hopefully that one's
probably not going to be on. I mean, I know the last time I have a DVD copy of it, and last time I checked, it was going for like $70.
Wow.
It is very out of print.
Nice.
Yeah.
So my number four is, and it's my four through two are going to be really similar picks just because they're movies that I liked when I was younger. Number four is The Emperor's New Groove, which is, of course, the Disney one.
Nice.
Starring David Spade and John Goodman, and this one is just almost an exercise in pure silliness.
Yeah.
Just all of like the crazy things that, you know, you love about like early Family Guy episodes where there's like these very non sequitur jokes, and it's just so zany and fun that, you know, you can't help but love this movie, and I really like this one a lot.
That's a great pick. Okay. Well, on to my number three, I'm going with a more recent one. This one's from 1993, Batman Mask of the Phantasm.
Oh, good one.
And I think, like, for me especially, nothing defines Batman more, even more than, like, the Christopher Nolan ones now. I think that Bruce Timm and Paul Dini have really shaped what Batman is supposed to be. And from my perspective, I love the kind of retrofuturism of it, the dark gothic aesthetic. They were the ones that really drove home the dark, sinister pasts to the characters rather than, you know, the goofy, original, you know, like, you know, Mr. Freeze was just like, had the gimmicky suit and the weird little ray gun. And in this one, it's like, you know, his wife died and he's just trying to bring her back to life. Like, these characters have so much more depth and meaning. And Mask of the Phantasm is like, they gave him a huge budget and just told him, go make a full-length movie. And it's, I still think it's one of the best Batman properties around.
I definitely agree. My number three, another Disney movie from when I was a kid, Sword in the Stone. And I think this one,
that's a great pick.
Yeah, I think this one's a little bit underappreciated. You know, a lot of the Disney movies that are remembered and considered like the Disney masterpieces are, you know, adaptations of like fairy tales like Pinocchio and Sleeping Beauty. And a lot of them have to do with like damsels in distress and princesses, you know, like Snow White and Little Mermaid and all that. And I think that Sword in the Stone, this really zany take on like a King Arthur origin story,
mm-hmm.
is a really fun movie, and it's got some of the best songs in Disney movies. I think a lot of the music is underappreciated, but it takes a much more a grounded medieval tone than a lot of the other Disney fantasy movies where, you know, you have these people living in a castle and it's real dank and drab in there. And it's more like an actual castle, and the politics of the movie where you have different people competing over rulership and different noblemen and holding this tournament to decide the fate of a country,
mm-hmm.
is much more grounded in reality rather than, you know, a bunch of fairies putting a curse on a girl to prick her finger, you know, whatever happens, Sleeping Beauty. Anyway, but it does have a talking owl.
So trivial. What a trivial film that one was.
Yes, it's. I time's gonna tell on this one. Sword in the Stone's a better movie.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, that's pretty much all I wanted to say about Sword in the Stone. You know, it's got all this like the really cool sequences where, you know, he changes into a squirrel and a fish and all kinds of different stuff. And there's a talking owl who's really disdainful of everything that's happening in the movie. He comes real close to breaking the fourth wall a couple times. But anyway, it's one of my favorite animated movies of all time, and it's number 3 on my list.
Okay. Well, then on to number 2 on my list. And do you remember when we did our anime episode, like,
yes,
a year and a half ago? It's been a while since we did it. Like, we did a top 5 second best anime features of all time, because, of course, the number 1 anime of all time is Akira.
Right.
So Akira's number 2 on my list.
Well, something beat it.
Yeah, a really good movie beat it.
Interesting.
But, yeah, Akira is fucking amazing. It is such a beautiful film. It's so dark and gritty, and it's everything I love about science fiction. Just one of the finest films of any kind ever made.
All right. My number 2 is actually the first movie I ever saw in a theater, and it's The Jungle Book.
Oh,
another Disney movie, yeah.
That's nice.
And it's my number 2 a lot of because of nostalgia, because it is the first movie I ever saw in a theater. And I really like the music in this one. It's all real catchy and upbeat. And you have these, like, homages to different musical figures. I mean, you have the four vultures who are basically the Beatles, which is really fun. And it's just a real fun, good time, and a lot of crazy humor, and a lot of things that I like about both The Emperor's New Groove and Sword in the Stone mixed into one movie.
Yeah. All right, well, on to my number 1, and this is the finest Disney film made, Sleeping Beauty, you asshole.
Oh, fuck you.
Yeah, no, Sleeping Beauty is amazing. It is such a great movie. It's the final fantasy, or the final fairy tale film made by Disney in the Golden Age. It came out in 1959, and, you know, it took them 10 years to make that movie.
Really? I spent 10 years on that?
Yeah, and if you watch the other ones that came out before it, it is so far ahead of its time. It is unreal just how beautiful that movie. You really need to go back and revisit it. I don't think you have the freshest memory of this. There are sequences in that movie that rival what they do today. I still think it is so beautiful. That final showdown between what is it, the Malevolus or whatever the villain's name is.
Yeah, the aptly named
evil
queen.
Precisely. When she goes into her dragon mode, like, I remember seeing that as a kid and just being completely blown away, and it still holds up to this day. Love it.
So my number 1 is not Sleeping Beauty, but it's also not a kid's movie. It's, of course, South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut.
Almost made my list.
Yeah? What bumped it off?
Anyway. Waking Life. Well, just because, you know, I thought it mixed it up a little bit.
Yeah, which is good. So I think our lists are completely different.
I think I just used South Park. No, I used Sheila Broflovsky on our list a while ago for...
Oh, that's
like,
right.
Like,
yeah.
Religious zealots.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. But yeah, South Park, it's, you know, a really simplistic animation style, but got this really biting social commentary and fantastically witty songs. It's
amazing music, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of, like, the movies that Trey Parker and Matt Stone do have really fantastic music in it, and they use music for comedy so well. It's they've turned it into, like, this niche genre that, you know, actually, you know, Spinal Tap probably helped them out a lot with that. But they really have a corner on that market.
I think also, like, Rocky Horror, where Rocky Horror is knowingly bad music, but it's still got the hooks to make it enjoyable. That's their idea. Is like they're like, every time they're making fun of musicals when they make a musical. They're making fun of all of these tropes associated with the way you structure songs. They're incredibly clever and very subversively funny.
Yep, so that's my number 1. Any honorable mentions that you want to throw out?
If I named one, I'd have to name 100. Like, this was an impossible list to compile. Like, South Park, you know, Toy Story, where one's Iron Giant. I love
Iron Giant. Yeah, that's one that almost made my list.
I mean, in 1,000 anime features as well. You know, it's really, because this was so broad, it's really hard to figure out exactly what the top 5 were, so I just went with a grab bag of all sorts of stuff.
Very cool. So that's going to go ahead and bring this show to a close. If you have any questions or comments or different takes on any of the movies we talked about, you can shoot us an email. I'm John, J-O-N, at GamersUnanimous.com.
And I'm Ryan, at GamersUnanimous.com.
Follow us on Facebook at GamersUnanimous, also on Twitter at GamersUnanimous, and keep up with our blog on my IGN. So until next week, everybody.
Later.